Options for the new prison site have been narrowed down. From SDPB, today is Monday, June 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we explore the latest potential communities for the prison facility, including Mitchell, Worthing, Springfield, and Sioux Falls. We'll talk with SDPB's Jackson Dirks about possible sites. Plus, we head back to Mitchell for a visit with Joel Allen about the McGovern Center for Leadership and Public Service. We will dive into purpose and role of civil discourse, as well as research on the impact of faith communities. But first, an update on an alleged politically motivated assassination in Minnesota, the massive manhunt that had South Dakotans on the lookout, and the cost of political and ideological divide in America. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This weekend, Americans were shocked by an alleged politically motivated assassination in Minnesota. The top Democrat in the Minnesota House, Melissa Hortman, was shot and killed in her home. Her husband was also killed in the attack. The couple leaves behind two children. After a massive manhunt, the alleged gunman is now in custody. According to Minnesota Public Radio, Hortman was Speaker of the Minnesota House from 2019 through 2025. NPR's Clay Masters reports she stepped aside as Speaker as part of a leadership deal. Hortman was a consensus builder who was key in supporting initiatives like abortion access, gun restrictions, and universal lunch for students. She was also no stranger to how political deal-making impacted average citizens. Hortman helped negotiate a budget deal that was passed earlier this week in Minnesota. Here is NPR's Clay Masters.
Hortman would be the only Democrat in the House to vote for a measure that removed Minnesota care for undocumented adults in the state. It was a part of that leadership deal. And in her final press conference on the steps outside the Minnesota House chamber, she was visibly upset.
What I worry about is the people who will lose their health insurance. I know that people will be hurt by that vote, and we worked very hard to try to get a budget deal that wouldn't include that provision. And we tried any other way we could to come to a budget agreement with Republicans, and they wouldn't have it.
She said she did what leaders do, stepped up and got the job done for Minnesota.
That's Clay Masters reporting for Minnesota Public Radio. Christopher Vondracek is a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He joins us on the phone from Washington with details on how the story unfolded across the nation.
Like there was a sharpness, a toughness about her, but there was also kind of a gracefulness and a humor with how she was able to pass, particularly when they had the DFL ran two chambers and the governor's office in 23 and 24, passed a slew of progressive priorities from codifying abortion rights to bringing free universal school lunches to kids across Minnesota, doing a lot of environmental work. That was what I, you know, knew of her professionally, so to speak. What was really impactful to me as I was writing and listening to different colleagues was there was one gentleman, our now former Representative Pat Garofalo, who's a Republican out of Farmington, the suburb of Minneapolis. And he told me, he said, she was the most consequential Speaker of the House in Minnesota history. And he basically said, and I didn't agree with her on much, but, you know, they had been freshmen together in 2004, and there was a friendship and a bond that transcended politics. And in some ways, she was sort of the best of what you hope for in an elected official.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the manhunt for the alleged gunman who is now in custody at the time that you and I are recording this. But for much of the weekend, that was uncertain. What are some key elements for you that you think are relevant for how that manhunt unfolded?
He was basically apprehended at dusk or after dusk last night, east of a little town called Green Isle, Minnesota, which is in Sibley County, which is right along the Minnesota River into the south central Minnesota. This is farm country, some wooded area, and there was a massive manhunt. I've heard it referred to as the largest manhunt in Minnesota state history. Hundreds of officers and SWAT teams, state, local, federal, agencies brought in to do it, and how he was found eventually was because he was, you know, near his farmhouse, and he had been spotted on a game camera that a neighbor called in, and then they used the drone to find out where he was and then surrounded him. And so he was apprehended without any shots being fired. The whole sort of weekend of events sort of swept across the state of Minnesota because the assassination of Hortman is in Brooklyn Park, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, and the shooting of Senator Hoffman and his wife, and I should say, and Melissa's husband was also killed in that attack at her home in Brooklyn Park. And then Senator Hoffman and his wife, Yvette, they were shot in their home in the middle of the night in Champlin, which is the next suburb over in that northern part of the Twin Cities area. Mm-hmm. And then Saturday, Bolter's wife and some relatives were actually detained at a little gas station in the Casey's gas station south of Lake Mille Lacs. Of course, the manhunt sort of circled down into southern Minnesota. And so there was a sense that people across the state were on high alert.
We have seen some reports that that the gunman might have been in Mitchell. That's not accurate, though, right? Do authorities think that the gunman ever went or headed to South Dakota?
Correct. No. Authorities said last night they never believed that he was in South Dakota, that there had been essentially a bolo, a be on the lookout that's customarily shared with different agencies across state lines because there was a nationwide warrant for Bolter, Vance Luther Bolter's arrest. It's customary to share that with other agencies. That's how information had sort of enveloped folks in South Dakota.
Everyone was on the lookout. The alleged gunman is now in custody, and I'm going to direct people to your reporting at the Star Tribune that you have done and other reporters have done for the latest online and in print. Thank you so much for being here with the update. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.
That's the Star Tribune's Christopher Vondracek. SDPB reached out to South Dakota political leaders over the weekend for their responses to the events as they unfolded. Here is South Dakota Representative Scott Odenbach.
We all know people in Minnesota. My wife grew up in Minneapolis, and I was married in Plymouth, and my father-in-law lives outside of Minneapolis. So we all have those ties. It's a crazy time we live in when that type of thing starts happening. I just want everybody to stay vigilant and stay safe and keep on believing in our system of government where we resolve things through civil debate.
South Dakota Representative Scott Odenbach. Now, later in the hour, we will see how the community of Mitchell is working on conversations that find consensus and compromise in times of stark political and ideological divide. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Now that a governor-appointed task force has narrowed the number of possible sites for a new men's prison, the remaining communities are speaking out as well. The Project Prison Reset Task Force has eliminated what was once the most likely site in Lincoln County for a new men's prison. Now the communities of Mitchell, Worthing, Springfield, and Sioux Falls remain as possible locations for new or expanded prison facilities. SDPB's Jackson Dirks has been following the discourse. He sat down with me and SDPB's Kirby family in Sioux Falls with an update. Jackson Dirks, welcome back to the studio. Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, I read your reporting, and the leaders in Mitchell are withdrawing their support for a new prison to come to the city of Mitchell. What happened?
So I guess to answer that, we have to go back a bit to the most recent Project Prison Reset Task Force, where a lot of Mitchell people were throwing their support behind the idea of bringing the prison there, specifically people in favor of economic development. They want to see that $600 million come to Mitchell. They want to see those 400 jobs that are going to be brought come to Mitchell. And so between that period and now, we've sort of seen there was a little pause, and then Davison County Sheriff Steve Haar, he came out against it, and he had initially signed a letter throwing the support behind, I believe the wording was, starting a conversation about having the prison in Mitchell. So maybe not necessarily supporting the prison entirely, but he wanted those conversations to happen. And so then on Facebook, he has a public letter out saying that he does not support it, and he doesn't want it. He knows that people in Davison County do not want it. He's heard that. So then fast forward a day later, mm-hmm. Mitchell Mayer says the same thing, that, quote, effective immediately, I do not and will not support this proposed prison project in the Mitchell community. And so initially for me, I thought that was interesting because I know that Mitchell Mayer Hansen, he's very outspoken in wanting to grow Mitchell. He wants mm-hmm. to grow it. He knows that maybe not everybody in Mitchell does, but that's where he has sort of aligned with wanting to grow and see some economic development. And so I asked him about that. I said, obviously, this is something you have set out by 2035. You want to see a pretty significant level of that. And he essentially, his answer was not this way.
Yeah.
And why is because it's just been so divided. Everybody's against it from what he says on the surface level. In response to his letter, he said that he got maybe 3 to 10 people that were upset that he sort of flip-flopped. But he said the majority of people are very happy and they feel like they're being represented now well.
So he's making the distinction between flip-flopping and simply listening to mm-hmm. the public input that has flooded his office since the narrative really took hold that mm-hmm. Mitchell wanted it in their town. Many people in Mitchell said, not so fast, we don't want it. And then he said, mm-hmm. I hear you. And I would respond, which I'm mm-hmm. guessing he would say is different than flip-flopping.
Yeah, essentially. And if you have time, definitely look at the letter because it's pretty genuine. He comes out and he says, like, I was in support of this, or I was kind of throwing my backing behind this, and that's not what my job is. He says his job is to represent the people of Mitchell. And so regardless of what he thinks, he said that he's not going to support it because that's what he's heard, and that's what the majority of people are saying is they do not want it.
Right. That's not necessarily a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because the state of South Dakota can still put the prison where they want to put the prison, but it is a significant
mm-hmm.
Part of the conversation going forward. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And completely. And so one of these interesting tidbits, I guess, I've kind of been following is just sort of why are people against it? I mean, obviously nobody wants necessarily a prison in their backyard or anything, but what is the main concern? And so with Davidson County Sheriff Steve Haar, I asked him, and I just asked about the safety aspect, because as a sheriff, you should have a pretty good gauge on that. And he said, well, necessarily, people aren't going to be unsafe. I mean, there's going to be state officers there. There's going to be a lot of heavy security there. But he said there is that stigma around it, that maybe it is a little more unsafe. And he also said there's the worry about maybe people getting let off the street, some prisoners, and then there are reoffenders. Maybe they're let off in Mitchell. And then on the flip side, I know Mitchell Mayer said he said everything. He's heard everything, every reason why. But what's interesting is he said it's not his job to justify their reasons. It's his job to represent them. And so so I thought that was an interesting thing he had said.
And I say this every time that we talk about the prison. You and I right now in the Kirby Family Studio in SDPB Studios in Sioux Falls are sitting within a mile of, I think it's within a mile, certainly within 2 miles, of the current mm-hmm. prison, which is literally crumbling around.
Yes.
So the safety concerns, this mayor says, it's not really up to him to say whether or not that's legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to honor the fact that mm-hmm. that's what people are saying.
Yeah, and there are definitely, I think, too, where you're going to see in these smaller towns, like that's another concern in Worthing is where the workforce isn't there. And Mitchell, I mean, they're already struggling to get people in decently paid jobs from what Mayor Hansen told me.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're wondering, I mean, people are concerned, how are you going to fill 400 full-time jobs? You would hope the state is going to be able to do that.
Empty out other businesses. Mm-hmm. Other people are going to go to the prison jobs mm-hmm. instead too, which is another. So back to what he said about, yes, we want to grow, but that's not the right way
mm-hmm.
to do it.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, what about, I mentioned Sioux Falls. There are other communities impacted, including the city of Sioux Falls. Have you heard anything from the Sioux Falls mayor or other people who are having an outcry about mm-hmm. wanting it out of their community? It's been here for more than 100 mm-hmm. years. Is that taking hold? Is there a not in my backyard contingent from Sioux Falls yet?
From what I've seen, not yet. I think part of it is because, I mean, up until literally this week, a lot of people, or up until last week, a lot of people had thought Mitchell was going to be the spot. I mean, they were asking for it. They wanted it. And then now that switched. I think we're going to see a lot of legislators definitely look to Sioux Falls now and maybe just expanding. The question is, how do you get a 50 to 100 year solution whenever maybe the beds aren't there on the Sioux Falls the Sioux Falls site. That's going to be the big question. And on top of it, they want to see recidivism, and they want to see a lot more of these rehabilitative programs. And how do you fit that in a $600 million budget, which is less than what is expected?
Yeah. How do we build the prison of the future in the politics of today? Worthing, South Dakota?
Yeah, Worthing is certainly an interesting one. So I talked to the mayor of Worthing, Crystal Jacobson, and she said one of the really interesting things is the city didn't even find out they were one of the final contenders except through the news. So I guess it's a private landowner who had put together, they had some land and they wanted to sell it, and then Sioux Metro Area Growth Alliance put that bid out there. And so they had kind of thought, well, it's way more expensive than any of the other sites, and maybe the Lincoln County site would be more likely since they're not too far apart. And then they found out through the news, through us, people, media like SDPB, that they're a contender for the final four spots, which was interesting. And she said, not a lot of safety concerns there. I mean, I think there are some from the public, but she said as an official in Worthing, she said they do not have the infrastructure. And it would be pretty frustrating to her that where half of the town right now, the roads are old gravel roads and probably could use some redoing, that then they'd have to be spending money on new infrastructure. And she said that would be something that'd be hard to grapple with.
So where does this leave the Prison Project Reset Committee? Because they have a limited amount of time to come up with their proposal.
So July 8th is when the project proposals, like sort of what they can get under that $600 million budget. That's when the...
And it was $800 million?
It was originally, I believe, $825 million.
Okay. Yep.
They knocked it down to $600 million. So what the developers can do with that money, and the developer said at the most recent meeting that it might not be what they want, because $600 million isn't as much money as they probably need to address the growing need for a prison over a 100-year span.
Okay, yeah.
And so...
You said July 8th. I interrupted you. What happens in July 8th?
July 8th, they'll hear those proposals. So for all the sites, they'll hear the proposal for Mitchell, Worthing, the Springfield site, and Sioux Falls, and what those look like, what they can get, how many beds can be added. And then from there, there will be a special session. We don't know when. It was originally scheduled for July 22nd. Lieutenant Governor Tony Van Huysen, he's the chair of the committee, or the chair of the task force, he asked for an extension on that. We don't know when that is yet, but there will be a special session addressing it, and then we'll kind of see from there.
All right. We will continue to follow your coverage at sdpb.org. Jackson Dirks, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The McGovern Center for Leadership and Public Service at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell revolves around civil discourse. The center strives to be the living legacy of Eleanor and Senator George McGovern. It hosts events, puts out podcasts, and is home to a McGovern Museum. The In the Moment crew drove to Mitchell to tour the center, where I spoke with Director Joel Allen. He's also a professor of religion and philosophy at Dakota Wesleyan. We'll begin here with the mission and purpose of the McGovern Center. Then we'll talk about the role the center is playing in the community debate over a potential men's prison in Mitchell. Finally, Dr. Allen will offer insight into some research into the impact of faith communities that is encouraging his work as both a faith leader and a religion professor. Take a listen. Dr. Joel Allen, we are seated here in your office at the McGovern Center in the library at Dakota Wesleyan University, and I think it's just an acoustically beautiful space.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds nice in here, in other words.
Yeah, this is George's old office, and it's a real privilege for me to be able to inhabit this space as my office. So I'm the only person on the faculty that has their own fireplace. And I do not deserve it, Lori. You just have to know that. But it's got all kinds of memories of George, photographs of when he was a student, when he was a professor here, when he worked for Food for Peace, when he ran for president, and one from his days as an ambassador for the World Food Program out of Rome.
Wow.
So, when his elderly years.
So he is by far the most famous graduate of Dakota Wesleyan and Eleanor.
Yes, he and Eleanor would be by far, I think, the most famous of our graduates, and really the only South Dakotan to ever run for president and win party nomination of a major political party. So he's the closest to the presidency any South Dakotan has ever gotten.
Right, and yet on the wall over my right shoulder is a tribute to not a win, but what might have been. Tell me about this framed piece, because it's so interesting.
It's it says McGovern elected in upset backwards, and it's it's on the kind of steel that used to be used for printing newspapers in the 70s. So what happened was, most newspapers would, they knew that one of two things were going to happen.
Right.
They'd print both headlines and kind of have them ready to go. And then they sometimes would even start printing newspapers. And of course, the famous one is Dewey defeats Truman. Right. So
it did not happen.
Truman won that election, and he was glad to hold up the corrected incorrect copy.
Yeah.
But this didn't get that far. Mm-hmm. It says McGovern elected an upset. So a friend of a friend was walking out of the print shop where they were printing up the newspaper for the day, and he looked down and saw that, and he picked it up and gave it to a friend of his about 20 years later, and that friend gave it to me about 20 years later, and I have it now on the wall of the office. And so it's just kind of a fun homage to what the future, the past as it might have been, as we hope it would have, could have been. But
The dustbin of history leaves some treasures and some imaginative prompts
for South Dakotans
today.
Yeah.
What is the mission? You know, what's your job today? What's the mission of the McGovern Center today?
Well, leadership and public service are the two main themes. So we work with our community and our students both. We do both work on campus and off, providing, for instance, service opportunities. So we provide, we organize the big day of service. And so we send students all over the campus and the city, and they do all kinds of work, from everything you can imagine, from cleaning to, you know, cleaning out the river to helping. We're hoping that next year we'll, you know, do some work on a habitat house and that kind of thing. Our students are all over town. And it's just a really fun day. It's kind of something the McGovern Center's been doing for many years. But then also we provide opportunities for students to get involved in leadership experiences. And we do that primarily through this Braver Angels connection that we've talked about before. And so we provide opportunities for students to be involved in civic debate, civic discourse, which is such a needed. Mm-hmm. In fact, even in today's Mitchell Daily Republic, there's an opinion piece about how we need to teach people civics again and teach them how to engage in civic discussions publicly. And so this is a way of doing that. So our theme this last semester was on immigration and amnesty. So we had a resolution that said that we ought to have a pathway of amnesty for people that have been here that haven't broken the law and are paying taxes, et cetera. And so we had students that got involved in this debate, and they debated it in a classroom and then came in and debated it. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people from the community here, and they got involved in the debate. So it's an opportunity for students and community members to get involved in debate things. Last semester before that, we did Is America a Christian Nation? Yeah. Very interesting topic for debate. The semester before that, we did the three of the different initiated measures or constitutional amendments. And then we had a great event with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, where that was just one of the best. So that's the kind of thing we do.
These are non-adversarial debates in the sense that they're, tell me what the difference is. You know, it's not debating to win; it's debating to understand.
It's a good point. So the way I like to describe it is a traditional debate. It has rules that that are geared toward providing kind of win-loss ratio. So in an Oxford-style debate, you take a straw poll at the beginning, you have the debate, take a straw poll at the end, and whoever wins votes wins the debate. It's very simple, but it works very effectively. And so this is a very different style of debate. This is a debate that encourages conversation, respectful conversation. There's some structures to make that happen. And it produces a kind of a culture that I like to call the Brave Angels magic. In other words, everybody at the very beginning kind of makes a commitment and an intention to listen to what the other person says carefully and with really genuinely trying to understand it rather than the gotcha. And then if you do it for them, they do it for you kind of thing. And so it's that learning that mutual respect that the winners of these kinds of debates are people that keep the conversation going and draw a little bit more understanding out of that conversation and keep the conversation going. So there's an old set of distinctions between finite games and infinite games. Mm-hmm. And I like to think this takes what is a finite game, in other words, a limited set of rules and a win-loss result, to a infinite game where the whole game is set up to initiate conversation that continues and that brings people closer together in understanding. There's no win-loss about it. And so that's what we do. We take what's often a finite game and make it an infinite game.
And this is important for the students in their studies. Yeah. And for the community of Mitchell, mm-hmm. but for the students in their studies, what do you hope they will take with them long after they have left Dakota Wesleyan?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I hope they take with them the realization that civil conversation is possible and that it's meaningful, that real dialogue can happen. We just have to kind of set our intention about having the values right so that we're not looking at trying to defeat someone or prove someone wrong or sound the best in the, you know, by pulling down all the facts that are so impressive. It's not that. It's and so by students coming, my goal, and I think that this is effective in many ways, that they walk away from it with this can happen. Real debate can produce kind of a quality. I think I can't help but think of Robert Putnam's, you know, the whole idea of social capital. There we are.
I get the idea. Yeah.
So in other words, we need, for democracy to really work, we need to have a deep level of trust. Mm. It doesn't work if we fundamentally think that everybody else is cheating. And democracy requires that, and Putnam really showed that's developed in small groups of people where we really interact. And so, in other words, I think of these debates as something that builds social capital. They help people to really hear that the other person's got a good intention, they just have a difference of opinion. And by listening, by hearing, by interacting, you're developing that trust component, that trust level that is essential to social capital. And social capital is like the bedrock of democracy. Yeah. And so, I think I'm going to go back there. I'm going to say, hey, we're doing something that even has value and you know, this kind of significance by rebuilding this framework that's been so shattered.
So it's urgent work.
Yeah.
But it's also work that requires patience.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you might not see rewarded with the urgency that you might like.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I've been recently really encouraged on this score because I've been doing this now for several years. I should count up on my fingers how many, but it's been at least three. So we've done a lot of debates, right? And I've done a lot of the Oxford style debates too, mostly in classes. But so I've done a lot of this kind of thing. But the other day, something happened that was completely different that brought it to a new level, and that is I got a telephone call from the mayor, who's been to some of our debates and really loved them and participated, asking me if we could have a Braver Angel style debate or community conversation or courageous conversation, whatever name we want to give them, that if we could have one of those for the most controversial. We've already done one for the issue of the lake, and the lake was a $25 million project, so it was real money we're debating. This one is almost $1 billion, and it's the construction of the new state prison. Mm-hmm. And he asked, would you be willing to have a debate on that? I think our community needs it. Now, there's going to be other forums, so this isn't the only place where we'll be discussing this. But right now, I can tell you in the city of Mitchell, there is tremendous difference of opinion. And so how can we be helpful to our community in providing a place where people can genuinely listen to each other and genuinely hear the positions that they're not? You know, a lot of people just have this right off the top, you know, initial kind of a knee-jerk reaction that, you know, we'll be a prison town. We don't want that, you know.
Right.
And so there's a lot of antipathy and rancor about this issue. Maybe not rancor, but strong feelings.
There could be. It could build to that.
It could build to that. Because
is a fairly recent. The lake had been a topic of discussion for a very long time.
Yes.
And it built to this, you know, dredging project, which I understand is going to be undertaken in the fall.
Yeah.
The prison project is...
It's new.
It's new. A few weeks, you know.
Just a few weeks ago.
Yeah. The ink is not yet dry on some of the headlines.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So we put in an application. So there's no, there'll be no vote on this.
It's
something that the state decides, but they of course want community input. And they want to have the prison in a place that is accepting or, you know, appreciative.
Supportive.
So
who do you gather around the table? And we've talked somewhat about the framework before. So there's a facilitator and, you know, there are rules to make it not only, you know, a courageous conversation by which you're going to say the things that need to be said, but also you're going to be listening to the things that need to be heard.
Right.
How do you set up the panelists or the speakers to make sure that the right people who have the most knowledge who can talk about both sides of the issue or multiple sides of an issue, as the case may be, are in the room?
The way we do it is, you know, like for instance, right before you came, I had sent out an email and a text to people that I know feel strongly on this issue and inviting them to come and speak. And I did it the other day and a guy was like, yeah, I'll be there. And then this person I really wanted to be here. And then he texted me and said, no, I can't. So you're working with people to set up the first few speeches. So you have a pro speech and a con speech, a pro speech and a con speech. And so I just go to the people that, for instance, right now there are Facebook pages, both battling Facebook pages.
Right.
And so I've gotten on there and I need to do this right on the Facebook page and say, hey, if you're interested in giving a speech, please let me know. Mm-hmm. So we try to get people that are kind of starting to take a leadership in the community type. In fact, right now, as we're speaking, a person comes to mind like, oh, I need to text her.
So
a friend of mine is taking a very, very strong con position. And so I'm going to text her and say, hey, would you be, and this person's comfortable with public speaking.
Right.
And so I'll say, hey, you know, would you, so we go into it from the start with a few pro speeches and a few con speeches. And so it starts out with, you lay out the ground rules and you just kind of explain how this works. And then you always start with a pro speech in the sense that you have a speech that's agreeing with the resolution. So the resolution is going to be, and we like to keep these resolutions very simple. And it's going to be Mitchell should be the construction, the new state prison should be constructed in Mitchell. The new, you know, men's state prison should be constructed in Mitchell. Just that's all you need.
That's it. Yeah.
And rather than some kind of long drawn out thing. Mm-hmm. And so we'll just have a first pro speech, and I'm getting help. The chamber is helping me with the pro speeches because they've kind of started. They started, you know, wrote the proposal to the state, so they're definitely on the pro side. And so they'll be, and I have no problem working with them. It's like, give me the best people you can. And then on the other side, I'll just get the best people I can. I want people to hear the best, the most. In the most, you know, consistently thoughtful people. Yeah.
That, articulate, fact-based, understand the opposition.
Absolutely.
To their own point. It seems to me that if you were, you know, against this, for example, that it would be very good for you to hear the best person speak for it and vice versa, so that you can also form your own argument.
You want a steel man, not a straw man.
I
came across that. I heard that. Well, it was John Hakkari, who was interviewed for quite a while. Anyway, I heard him use the term straw man or steel man. And I had never heard that before.
Immigration attorney, John.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Yeah. And so then do you have a sense of, do you have to measure an outcome?
Really not. What you do is a debrief at the end of, okay. So we'll go, and we try to not let these go too long. So after people give official speeches that we've asked to give speeches, it opens up the floor to anyone. Anyone can give a speech. And you don't even have to be pro or con to give a speech. You can give a speech to topic. And that's a speech where you talk about like a background issue that might help people make a choice. You know, there's really important information that's not exactly pro or con, but it's helpful information just the same. Yeah. So you can do that too. So, yeah.
Oh, fascinating stuff. All right. So on the Lake Project, what was the resolution and how did that match what's actually happening in the community eventually?
Yeah, the lake issue is really kind of calmed down. It won just by a scratch, and so they're going to start draining it later this year. So, but it's the issue seems to have died down. Everybody seems to be reconciled with the fact that we're going to get it dredged. Yeah.
At the conversation, was that the direction that was that emerged as the best, or is it contrary?
We didn't really. The lake debate was a very successful debate, but not the way it wasn't like a win-loss.
I'm looking for a winner and loser.
Yeah. Okay. It wasn't that, but what we came away with a sense of, I think we kind of lowered the temperature in the room in the sense that people realized, you know, they have some good points. I need to think about their points.
Yeah.
And then there was also just a real clear sense something has to be done, and we can't do it half-heartedly. We've got to do the whole shebang this time.
How often is that part of what people walk away with, which is something has to be done?
Yeah.
This is the moment in history that we're living in, and boy, we wish this wasn't left up to us.
But we were going to have to deal with it.
But we're going to have to deal with it, whether it's prison beds or lake pollution immigration reform. Boy, we wish that it wasn't this complicated.
But here it is.
Yeah, lowering the temperature like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I was listening to your podcast on my drive from Sioux Falls, A More Perfect Fellowship. Tell me a little bit about why fellowship and the faith-based connection to the podcast and the work that you do here.
Yeah. Well, I'm also an ordained United Methodist minister, and I'm the professor of religion here at Dakota Wesleyan, and so I increasingly have been thinking about the idea of social capital, as we were talking about before, the idea that our culture to be successful needs to have broad-based intelligent trust. In other words, to have a functioning civil union and to have a democracy that works and a community that we'd want to share with one another, we have to be able to hear each other and trust each other. And it's something that we were losing a lot in our culture. And it occurred to me that churches are a place where a lot of that happens. First of all, churches by far, you know, are civic gatherings of people. You have Kiwanis Club, you have, you know, Rotary, you have Lions Club, you have Exchange. You have Daughters of the American Revolution. I mean, just think of all the associations, bowling leagues, you know. Mm-hmm. We have all kinds of associations where people get together and they get to know each other and they build community and build trust. Yeah. Those are really important factors to have to produce a culture that works. But the most common place where people get together is in church, and, you know, by far the most common place. And so it just started occurring to me, churches, I wonder what would happen if churches, if pastors started seeing that as like part of their ministry, to build social capital in their community and to become a place where you build social capital in your community and where you do that more intentionally. And so I started thinking about, now what would it take? And so I started this podcast to encourage any kind of Christian leader, church leader, or really it could be, you know, another religion. That's no reason that it would have to be, because the fact is, anytime people get together and are, you know, in deep conversation with each other or have meaningful communion with each other, it builds social capital, and it's good for our culture and society. So I developed a podcast to encourage pastors, church leaders of any type, faith leaders of any type, to think about how their faith community can become more intentionally at work to build community, to build social capital in the community. How can we be a part of that? Yeah. So that's what the podcast is all about.
Yeah, the responsibility of that.
Yes, the responsibility.
For church leaders.
To think of pastors thinking. I mean, that's not the way we typically think as a pastor. We, you know, you do community events. We do, you know, but you're usually trying to build discipleship in your own congregation, and you're trying to encourage people to, you know, love each other and to live according to God's will and purpose and design and all of those kinds of things. But you don't think, I don't think many pastors think about the goal and the role of a church to be, to build, to make people better, function, to function better in a democratic society and culture, and to be better citizens too.
Yeah. So I listened to the episode with the author of the book, The Center Will Not
Hold.
David
Brubaker, yeah.
And one of the things that struck me in that was the awareness for faith leaders that people who are not in and of the faith might see church as polarizing and divisive by its nature. But yet for people within the church, they might be struggling with polarization in the congregation, but they don't see themselves the same way. Yeah. So for people who say, well, church itself is combative and polarizing, and I'm not interested in hearing what the faithful community has to say because of X, Y, Z, what would your response be?
Well, yeah, righto. You know, there are many, a lot of times churches kind of devolve into hyper-political systems. You know, we all hear about Christian nationalism these days, and that is the belief that God has like a special designation for the United States, a special role for us, and it's that role is being undercut by darker forces, and it's our job to fight back. So all of those components go into nationalism and seeing America as like a nation that we have to fight for because it's being attacked by those Jews or those Catholics or whatever.
Not exactly the Sermon on the Mount.
Not exactly the Sermon on the Mount, right. So the teachings of Jesus.
And yet the Sermon on the Mount is so hard.
It's hard for all.
Struggle with it. We all struggle with that, the, you know, what Jesus is telling people then, which is all about humility and tenderness. And sacrifice and grace. And those are tough words.
They're very tough words. And there's a great book written by Jonathan Rauch that where he divides Christianity up into different groups. One is the weak Christian groups, the sharp Christians, and then the thick Christians. Mm. So weak Christians are Christians that just don't really require much of anybody. Sharp Christians are like the ones that are wanting to defeat the, you know, the making sure that we pull out the books we disapprove of from the library and fighting at the city hall and, you know, all of the kinds of sharper types of things that where Christians try to kind of fight back against their culture. And then thick Christians are Christians who are wanting to be substantive in their faith in the sense of not fighting against their culture, but developing their own spiritual life by seeking to follow the teachings of Jesus. Yeah. And once we follow the teachings of Jesus, then we're becoming more the kind of place where church is building up social capital, as we were talking about before. And so that was kind of a helpful way to designate those in my mind.
Cross Purpose. Let's end with some other books. We've discussed several books. I noticed on your podcast you often ask people what they're reading. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading? Well, just for fun, I'm reading a book called Covenant of Water, which is a famous book. It's, I think, an Oprah book club.
A lot of pages.
I'm reading it on a Kindle, so I don't see that. But I've heard it's a lot of pages.
That's one way of doing it.
And so, and then I also am reading a book called The Soul of Civility. So it's a book by Alexander Hudson, and it's about, you know, developing a culture of civility. And of course, I'm reading that connected to the McGovern Center because I've been kind of considering using it in this context. And then there's a book on dialogue that I've been reading off and on. A really helpful book on dialogue and how dialogue happens. It's called The Magic of Dialogue. It's been around for a few years. And then what I've something, not a book, but I've been really interested recently in the fact that our culture is secularizing so quickly. People are, you know, more and more people today say religion means nothing to me than ever before. Yeah. It's a rapid process. We're really secularizing quickly. But the research, on the other hand, shows that people that are involved in faith communities are healthier. They live longer. I read one study that, and it was in Pew Research Center, so it was a good source of information. But one study that was done of obituaries. So they looked at two things. They looked at, did the obituary mention a church or faith community? And how old was the person when they died? That's just looked at those two things.
And they
They're
found...
consistently older. Consistently, significantly older. A lot of research, some of this has been questioned, this was in the Oxford Handbook on Religion and Health, that people that go to church regularly live 7 more years, and African American men that go to church regularly live 14 more years. Now, a lot of that isn't church exactly, but still, you get more time on earth if you're in church regularly. People that go to church regularly are more likely to be involved in the political process and go join committees. And this is, so it's like we have these two things that are happening at the same time.
So then what is the responsibility of a faith community to make sure everyone is welcome, and the people who have been damaged by church,
feel
like they cannot come in and feel any kind of peace, you know, what is the responsibility of a church then? Yeah. If that research is true, you have to be thinking about that very differently, about what your obligation is to the people who don't feel welcome.
Right. Yeah. I wish I had an answer to that question. But there's a lot of pain to undo, whole lot of pain.
Yeah.
And so I'm not in any way, you know, dodging that reality. But on the other hand, and this has also been really striking me when I'm just sitting in church, you know, just how uplifting and encouraging hymns and songs are. You know, if you really think of, there's most of them are like, you know, we were just singing this song in church the other day called So Will I. And it's like, if the heavens are made to sing your praises, so will I. It's that kind of, and it's a beautiful theme. It's one of my favorite of all the, I prefer hymns to chorus, to modern, but if you have to pick one, you know, this is one of my favorites. It's a beautiful song, and we just sang it in our annual conference the other day. But I just was thinking, this is really powerful stuff. This is encouraging, like God's with you in the sorrow that you're going through. God is, you know, by your side. So I think that the people that go to church get kind of this dose of positiveness that, and we saw this, my dad was a missionary in Mexico, and we saw it in Mexico all the time, that people would start going to church. They live a rough and tumble life, and then they start going to church, and pretty soon they're starting a business, and they're doing this, and they get married, and they have kids, and church produces a context for kind of a wholesomeness that. So I've been very interested in this research. I wanted to read more on it, but this is like done by, there's one called the Human Flourishing Project, where they're really looking at what causes people to flourish. And I watched, and this was at Harvard University, the scholars up there and saying, so far our research proves several things. One is that young people are not doing as well as they were, which I thought was interesting. Young people are not thriving. So this is testing human flourishing on the basis of six different, anyway. So, but the other one was, we can also see with very clear, without, you know, doubt of contradiction, that there's something between religious faith and flourishing that's going on here.
Joel Allen is a professor of religion and philosophy at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. He is the director of the McGovern Center for Leadership and Public Service at Dakota Wesleyan. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. thank you for listening.